Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. During the pandemic, Lucy Sant sent an email to her closest friends with the subject line, a bombshell, a secret she'd been keeping for more than 60 years. Lucy was a woman, not the man she'd pretended to be for decades. She introduced her friends to Lucy, then a Vanity Fair article introduced Lucy to the world. The whole experience is chronicled in her new book, I Heard Her Call My Name. It's a memoir about transition, and it's a story about accepting yourself, no matter your age. Author Lucy Sant joins me now. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi, glad to be here, Anna.
Your memoir begins with a quote from Henry David Thoreau's Walden. Beware of all enterprises that require new clothes, and not rather a new wearer of clothes. I love that quote for many, many personal reasons. But I wanted to know, what was the significance? Why did you want to begin there?
It was kind of a chance operation, really. The funny thing is that this was a quote that had been in my head since I was married to my first wife, who was very much a Thoreau scholar, and used to quote that line, the first half of the line, to me all the time. Beware of all enterprises that require new clothes. But she almost left out part two. And it was actually while looking up this quote that I discovered the second part to it. And it seemed so perfect. And it just, right then, before I'd even written the line of the book, it became the epigraph.
You begin the actual writing of the book with a personal email, not something you drafted or edited for thousands of people to read. It felt so deeply personal and something that maybe wasn't even intended for publication at the time it was written. I have to ask, how did you decide to start with that email, and how did you have the confidence to begin with such an intimate piece of correspondence?
Well, I'd written about 20 pages of a beginning, which was, it was defensive, it was apologetic, it was like putting up hedges. And I showed it to my friend, the writer Daryl Pinkney, and he said, come on, this is nonsense. You have to start at the beginning. And that's when I realized I had no choice but to put down that letter, even though it left me feeling very exposed. I mean, there's things in there that perhaps I wouldn't have put in a book otherwise, but I felt compelled toward total honesty. It's very raw. At the same time, though, my subconscious was operating on all six cylinders, and it managed to really tell the whole story in a more concise way than I might have if I'd been doing it in less sort of emergency conditions.
Yeah, that answers kind of my next question, which was, did you edit it for publication? But it sounds like the answer was no.
Not a word. Yeah.
Ah, that has to be so scary.
Yeah. But, the whole thing is scary. So what's one little scare compared to the big overall scare, right?
Yeah. And you, in that email, you talk about how you finally use the phrase cracked your egg. And for someone who strikes me as so analog, who perhaps prefers paper and pen to computers, who likes tangible objects, it was really surprising to me that it was a piece of technology, an app for your smartphone that finally cracked that egg.
I know, right? I mean, it's artificial intelligence, in fact, which terrifies me. I'm innumerate. I don't know how computers work, etc. I did not get a computer until I was well into my 40s. I'm totally a creature of the 20th century, of the analog age. And yet, not only was it this app that just, struck off the firing pin, as it were. But also, I mean, I really learned about what it was to be transgender from the app, because there were no such materials available when I was a child, when I was an adolescent, even in my early adulthood. I really couldn't find much information without the kind of digging that would have exposed me, if you know what I mean. Everything had to be done surreptitiously. And suddenly online, it was all this information. I found out about hormones. I found out that no, I really wasn't the only person in the world who felt this way. Stuff like that. I probably would not have happened without the internet. And I would have gone to my grave as I had been intending to, shielding my secret.
Yeah, it was an application that allows you to change the gender of your photographs. So I think, a lot of anybody who's used social media has probably seen this, where you can see yourself as a guy or see yourself as a girl or whatever, change your hair color, change your eye color, like mess with your physical appearance. And what's fascinating to me is it set off this firestorm of you like digging through shoe boxes and bags and all the places you had any kind of photograph of yourself to, in a sense, reimagine your life. All these moments as a woman.
That's right. That was almost my first thought. I had to see how I would have looked in the past because, I'd altered photographs every now and again, always immediately tossing the results. Nothing was very satisfying. I'd always want to see what would I look like if I were a woman. And here, finally, I had an answer. And so I had to apply that retrospectively to my entire life, or at least beginning around the time when I first knew, which is to say 9 or 10. And I was amazed. It suddenly I realized the magnitude of all this. It wasn't just seeing a picture of myself as a woman. I had to realize that in my brain, in my back brain, I had been living this life. This was my alternate life, which had been going on inside there for 60 years. It was really remarkable the way the AI was able to adapt to these black and white photographs or ID card photographs and give me sort of, the right period hairstyles and clothing. It was incredible. At that moment, of course, I knew A, that yeah, I was trans and there was no denying it, and I might as well just go for it. And B, I had a book. Of course, I'd have a book anyway because I'm a writer, but this was the determining factor.
You know what? The photographs, some of these face app photographs are included in the memoir. And do you ever look at them? Like, one of the weird things, and I don't know what the originals necessarily looked like, but in a lot of them, she looks so happy and confident. I don't know if that's how you looked in the photographs before, or if that's some
No,
weird quirk of the AI.
I somehow do look much more happy and confident in the altered photographs than in the originals, which are often featuring very awkward smiles. I hated smiling for the camera. I hated being on camera.
Do you feel like it because you didn't know how to smile, if that makes sense?
No, I knew what my smile looked like, and it didn't look very masculine.
Oh, so you were afraid of your smile.
Yes.
You know, one of the things I kept coming back to in the book, which I found really fascinating, is you're a nonfiction writer by trade. You didn't go down the fiction path. And as someone who spent a career striving to tell the truth, someone who interrogated the truths of others for a living, this test, this fundamental, this, sorry, this truth, this fundamental truth about yourself, you held secret for so long. Like, how do you square that? I mean, as somebody who was striving their entire career to tell the truth and yet somehow not telling the truth to themselves.
Right. Well, of course, I had long training in hiding things because I was an only child in a family of isolated immigrants with few friends. So it was very, very small and crowded room. And so the stuff I had to keep to myself, I had to figure out how to keep them under lock and key. Now, the other thing is that it wasn't a simple process of I knew all this and I'm keeping it a secret.
Right.
It was a very, very, very complicated mechanism that involved denial to myself, that involved attempts at deliberate forgetting. I was operating a Stasi, I was operating an East German spying on their own citizens game on myself. I you know, the apparatus is kind of awe-inspiring when I finally broke it down with a sledgehammer. You know, it every possible intellectual trick at my disposal went into concealing the existence of this, even to myself. You know, because I, anyway, you're going to ask me why, and I don't want to anticipate that.
No, but you know, I know it's cliche, but it really strikes me as the embodiment of the truth will set you free.
Yeah, oh, totally. Absolutely. It's incredible.
And it's also so relatable. Like, I found myself nodding along at so many different passages because there is no limit to the way humans live inauthentic lives. You know, we're all masking or playing our own version of dress up. And you're so right that it's so exhausting. I want to read a line from the middle of the book because I identified it with it so strongly. And you write, because of course I was dodging self-description, because I didn't want to be seen. And I didn't want to be seen because I didn't know who I was. And I was like, oh, like that is something, like it's taken me 40 years to get to a point where I'm comfortable with the woman that I am.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I had such a liminal identity anyway. You know, I mean, I recount in the book, I'm an only child with no first cousins. Even in Belgium, I was kind of isolated. And then we came here. I went to school without knowing the language, knowing a word of the language at first. And my parents were hardly better off than I was. They were isolated, they were anxious, they were depressed. You know, it's and on top of all of that, to have this gender thing dropped into my lap, as it were, my identity was already so slender, and then I was concealing a large portion of it. So you can imagine my navigating my life has not been easy, especially in my relations with others.
Yeah. You talk about your two wives and your partner who you two end up breaking up during this transition, which had to be difficult. And I wonder, there's this moment in the book where you write a second letter, second email that you never send. And it's sort of walking back the first one at least a little bit. And I wonder, did you ever feel for a moment like you wanted to hold back from your audience? Because you also talk about wanting to hold back from your partner in order to keep her as a romantic partner.
Yeah, there was this moment 2 weeks later when I tried to talk myself back into the closet. It was kind of that was the worst part of it. The whole debacle with breaking up with Mimi, you know, covered much of the next 6 or 8 months. As much as I was coming out by degrees to everybody I knew, and that was exhilarating. There was this counter pressure, which was kind of awful. You know, we've made peace and we're very close and we share a dog and stuff like that. So it's not like, you know, there's been this complete divorce, but as a romantic unit, we no longer exist.
Yeah, one of the things I've read is that there's the saying that when you transition, your friends and family transition with you. And that really like comes across in the book because your friends, your family, they all have a gamut of reactions to I'm not surprised, to I'm totally flabbergasted by this revelation.
Yes. Much along gender lines, by the way.
You know, one of the things that I also wondered about is you have made a career in writing and you have a distinctive voice, right? A voice that what that you've cultivated and developed over years of work. And you know, anybody who's ever tried to publish a novel has heard the phrase, voice is so important. It can be so critical. I wonder, did you ever worry about losing that voice in this process?
Well, I never worried about it. I wondered if it would change. I didn't think that it would be a problem if it did. And it's a question that a lot of people ask me this, you know, has your voice changed? I can't tell. You know, I'm still living in this body. Many changes have taken place, many of them physical. And yet, there is a continuity of I. That I has become stronger and maybe stranger, but it's still really the same I I've been carrying all my life. And as far as I know, it's the same I that carries onto the page. So I can tell you some, there have been behavioral changes. I've become all the kind of pussyfooting I used to do in my writing before is gone. I've become brutally honest as a result of the giant moment of candor. Candor has come to pervade my life, and to the degree that I'm sometimes undiplomatic in ways I wouldn't have been before, but no drama really. I'm just got to tell the truth, because the truth is, frankly, I mean, this is why I write nonfiction, for one thing. This precedes all that. The truth, however broken, however partial, is to me always more interesting.
I wonder if it's changed at all how you view the world. I read this article a couple of years ago from a transgender man who was amazed when he started testosterone and the way it changed the way he looked at women. The testosterone altered, and in some ways made it more primal, more visceral. And he was totally shocked to find himself being the kind of guy that might ogle a woman on the street.
Well, that all of that is very complicated, including my attraction to women, which is just more explicitly what it always was, which is a weird combination of wanting them and wanting to be them. Those two things almost always accompany one another, and it's odd. I'm still working that one out intellectually. And the way I see men, though, that's a really interesting thing, because before that, there were male, I mean, I wasn't, I never was a successful guy. I didn't have the guy interests, I didn't have the guy drives, etc. But I kind of accepted that there were norms, and that you followed those norms if you were going to be a guy. And now I see all that from the outside, and it's, as I say in the book, it's, one part hilarious, one part alarming, and one part boring. But I have, I mean, I look at men with this anthropological interest that I never was able to quite summon before. And as far as like gender in myself, I mean, I know the major thing is that I'm just much more connected to people than I ever was before. Both, and it can be hard to separate what is the effect of hormone replacement therapy, and what is the effect of having released this giant secret, having, feeling 3,000 pounds lighter now, has also altered my outlook on many things.
That's Lucy Sant. Her new memoir, I Heard Her Call My Name, is out now. Coming up, we're going to dive deeper into another narrative in Lucy's memoir, the memoir of emigrating to the United States. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour with author Lucy Sant. She's the author of a recent memoir, I Heard Her Call My Name. We've been talking about how your memoir details your transition journey, but it also details your childhood and your experience growing up. And I want to start with, you're born in Belgium, and then you moved to New Jersey with your parents in the late 50s. And you write that you feel as though you immigrated four different times, which is just fascinating to me, because you're like, it's got to be so disruptive. I can't imagine flying to the U.S., flying back, flying to the U.S., flying back.
We came the first time because the local industry in my town, which was textiles, something which had gone on for hundreds and hundreds of years, so many European industries died in the mid to late 50s and going on to the 70s. And my town was a one industry town, essentially, so the whole place just sank. And my father had a friend who was a war bride who married a soldier from New Jersey. And so we emigrated to New Jersey. And after 9 months, my father couldn't find a decent job, and my parents hated it here. So we went back. But then there were problems over there too, seemingly insoluble ones involving my grandparents and their use of our house, et cetera. And so we came back again, this time for good. But then my mother and I, and my mother really did not want to be in America. She wanted to be back in Belgium. So she took the excuses of the failing health of her two parents for she and I to go back for, 4 to 6 months stretches twice more. And by the way, there were three flights involved in those trips, and the rest were by boat because cheaper in those days. So I spent enough time in Belgium that I continued going to school there until the third grade. In fact, second and third grades, I did a bit of schooling in both countries, and those were very different experiences. I came out of it with my head slightly spinning, because it was not only a long transatlantic journey, but it was an immersion to completely different cultural worlds, including the fact that the United States was probably about 30 years ahead of Europe then in terms of technology and, its household goods. The quality of life was totally different. In Belgium, we were living in the 1930s.
And on top of all of that is this complicated relationship with your mother.
Oh, yeah.
And it goes throughout the book. And one of the moments that really struck me was you have this moment when you learn as an adult that your father never let your mother write a check, that he even went so far one time as to go to the house of this guy who did work, rip up the check, and write him a new one. And I thought that was so fascinating because I think it's so true that when you're a kid, you don't understand the nature of your parents' relationship. And it is that evolution of coming to understand why they are the way they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, frankly, I still don't think I understand it even now. My parents never had an argument or even a disagreement when I was in the room. They just segregated those two things entirely. My mother was difficult. She was the physical one. She hit me a lot. And beginning in early adolescence, she hit me every day. It's literally every day. My father never touched me. So my father was kind of my hero and my mother the villain. And my mother was a very unstable personality who was in and out of drug treatments and hospitals and shock therapy and everything else. And my father was steady. He just worked. That's mostly what he did. He worked rotating shifts at a factory so that I only saw him really 1 week out of three. Anyway, when my mother told me that, which came at the end of her life, and my father was already mute and from dementia caused by Parkinson's disease. So I couldn't ask him at that point. When she told me that story about the check and about him not allowing her a driver's license also, I did not know how to square it with the rest of his personality. And even now, that argument rages in my head. How did that happen? You know, because I never saw my father treating women badly. In fact, my father really enjoyed hanging out with women. He had more women friends than my mother did. So, you know, how did that work? Maybe he didn't trust my mother to, you know, since my mother was so unstable, maybe it was a guard against her more destructive probabilities or possibilities. I do not know.
Yeah, I think sometimes we forget how little we know about the intimate relationships of other people, even other people who are so close to us.
Yeah, truly.
The other story that you tell in the book, which I loved getting a window, is into the art scene in New York City, especially in the 70s. And you talk about going to CBGBs and seeing Patti Smith perform, and you are taking poetry classes at Columbia. It feels like this incredibly amazing moment in time, and I loved getting a window into how you fit into all of that. But at the same time, you are right on the edge of the Stonewall riots and the growth of drag shows and the birth of the modern LGBTQ movement. And so you're standing on the edge of it, but you never actually cross that line into it.
No, I didn't. I couldn't. Well, for one thing, I mean, I was fascinated by the transgender moment as it began then. I observed it as much as I could, reading the Village Voice and, you know, and later on, actually, during the 90s, when the Wigstock happened and the Pyramid Club and all that was less than a block from the office where I wrote my books. But I wasn't part of it. And I was attracted to it, but afraid of it. And also, you know, for me, I've always been attracted to women. And while I had many, many, many gay friends, I was not attracted to men, and the drag scene was connected to that gay male scene. So I felt warmly toward it, but I didn't feel like I was part of it, even, and you know, even admitting to myself that I was trans, there was still that kind of gap culturally. And meanwhile, there were so many other things to be paying attention to, you know, honestly. I had a very fortunate experience being dropped into New York City at that particular time and meeting the people I did. I met Jim Jarmusch in January 1973 at Columbia. I met Jean-Michel Basquiat either at a club or at a party, I'm not sure, but that was before he was famous. You know, so a lot of people, Nan Golden, the photographer, also I met her when she was a bartender. These people, there was what Brian Eno's word, "senius," you know, based on genius and scene, that was very operative. I think everybody's imagination was pushing everybody else's imagination. It was an ex very exciting moment, and I of course I was miserable through it because I wasn't doing anything myself because I didn't even know I was really a writer. Well, writing was not the hippest thing to do. And even though I knew I was a writer, I was trying to not be a writer because it wasn't sufficiently hip. That therein lies the tale.
You were working on poetry when you were first at Columbia, right?
Yeah. And poetry did have this cachet in the late 60s, very early 70s. It was really hip to be a penniless poet on the Lower East Side, but that didn't last all that long.
Yeah, but I will say you can see those roots in your writing. You have some really beautiful sentences. And I can tell that you think about the way that the words are going to sound inside of someone's head. And I think that comes across. So I don't think that training was for nothing, though, because you can definitely tell that you're steeped in poetry when you read your books.
Well, you know, a lot of that actually comes from my father, who was not educated. He left school at 13 to go to work, but he could recite a lot of the fables of La Fontaine from memory. And that, you know, La Fontaine is all about the music of the sound. And I absorbed that at an extremely early age.
I've always been slightly jealous of the people that are lyrical writers. It has that old world quality to it that it can feel timeless even though it's brand new. There also were a lot of connections that you made to the city, and I sort of wonder, because now you don't live in New York City, do you think you'll ever go back? Do you think you can go back? It's kind of a weird,
Well,
right? If the moment has passed.
I mean, I suppose I could go back, but I don't think I'd want to really. I mean, I think about it especially because I'm 70, and I have a house and a car, and I wonder when will it happen that I won't be able to take stairs. Where will I go? And I always like had the fantasy of living in a residential hotel. I don't even know if they make those anymore. Anyway, thing about New York, I go there all the time. I almost once a week I'm down in New York for one piece of business or another. And sure, I miss the city badly, but it's not this city. It's a city that no longer exists. And unfortunately, I'm finding that to be the case with cities. I love Paris. Paris is no longer the same. I was just in Brussels a few weeks ago. Brussels is no longer the same, etc. Cities have become corporate. They become chilly. They're unwelcoming. Yeah, you still get the same mix of classes on the avenue, but inside, you're not going to be rubbing elbows with people from a vastly different class every time you walk into a Chock Full of Nuts. It just doesn't happen anymore. That great ferment, the idea of the city as a place for ideas, as a place where young people can try and fail and try again, this is gone because of real estate, because of the profit motive, because of capitalism, let's face it. Capitalism will kill the very things that give it life, really. You're not going to have any more classic movies because it's just going to be factory product from now on because the conditions have changed and so on. I miss cities badly. But it I and frankly, and I live in a small city on the Hudson River, 90 miles north of New York, and I'm quite happy here, even though I don't know anybody really, even though I've been living here for 16 years. But it's a nice place, and as a setting for my old age, it's really pretty great, I've got to say.
Do you ever worry about that corporatization when it comes to book publishing? Because we see a lot of it now with independent, right? Or publishing more experimental novels yourself. So I guess that's the pushback. But generally, at least in traditional, like the big five publishing, it seems like they're more cautious than ever.
Yeah, I mean, well, I have multiple publishers. Well, I have two main publishers. Whoever is publishing my big books, which right now is Penguin, and whoever is publishing my small books, which is my friend Steve Connell, who operates out of Hamburg, Germany, as Verse Chorus Press, has put out four of my books. This is that's the way it is right now. Publishing in terms of taking chances, also in terms of, quality control, things like this. I have no complaints with the way anybody, but my book is perfect as far as I'm concerned. But I'm saying overall, there's far less attention to detail, far less valuing of far less taking chances on people. There's so many more books being published, and so many of them are just copies of other books, really. You kind of don't need to know about most books that come out. And of course, there's going to come a time, which will probably, I hope happen after my death, that the printed book on paper will no longer exist at all. And I would not be able to adapt to that. I can read stuff online, but it flies out of my memory immediately. I need the paper. I need the physical object.
But there's also been an explosion of literature like your memoir and fiction about people who are non-binary, who are gay, who are transgender. The world of fiction writing and nonfiction writing is so much more colorful than it was mm-hmm. when you were a kid.
Well, yeah, that this is a whole subject area that's been added. And, you know, gender consciousness in general, I mean, it just did not exist when I was a kid. Which, you know, as I mentioned briefly in my book, it was so non-existent that I actually was able to read stuff that was for girls. And, you know, it was kind of, I don't know how to explain it, but it was so immediately regarded as innocent. You know, there was no suspicion on any part of any adults that I was reading something I shouldn't be reading if I was reading girls' lit. But the polarization of the genders went along with this liberation, too. That's why you have gender reveal parties now, which never existed in the 20th century, ever. This is a completely made up recent phenomenon. So it's the backlash just accompanies the frontlash, you know. But yeah, there's a whole swelling of trans literature, some of it very good, and some of it in that category that's like testimonially important, but not really literature. I do care about that stuff. Sorry, sue me. you know, there's a transgender publishing house in Brooklyn whose parties I've gone to, and they publish great stuff, Little Puss Press. So, you know, there is this, and there are, believe me, there are now trans writers who are writing for trans readers and kind of consider you a sort of traitor if you're writing for cis people. Well, you know, I'm always going to be writing for cis people because it's the world I come from. But anyway, it's, you know, let 100 flowers bloom.
That was Lucy Sant, author of the new memoir, I Heard Her Call My Name. Coming up, what it means to embrace our own personal truths. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staber. Lucy Sant was in her 60s when she finally embraced herself, transitioning from the man she'd been pretending to be for decades into the woman she is today. Her new memoir chronicles that transition, and we've been speaking with Lucy this hour about her journey. I think as we age, we become more beholden to the sunk cost fallacy. We're too far into our careers or our relationships to change. And what I love about your book is the willingness to start over, the power of becoming a beginner all over again. And that, it's something that I do think we get less likely to want to change as we age.
It's crazy. I was already considering myself headed for the glue factory 10 years ago, and especially approaching the age of 70. You know, I'm probably about 2 months away from outliving my oldest grandparent. Of course, that was because they, you know, were subjected to poor people's medicine in pre-war Europe. But nevertheless, it was a totemic number for me, 70. Will I live to see 70? So to be like being a teenager at 70 is distinctly weird. to be a teenager when parts of my body, notably my knees, don't really want to cooperate in the venture. That's weird. To be a newborn coming out into the world when, a lot of people already knew my name. That's weird. It's so many paradoxes rolled up into one.
Yeah, but I do think it's a good lesson for anyone that, it's never too late to make those changes. Like, if you're 40 or 50 and you hate your career, you can go back to school and start again. If you are trapped in a relationship that you do not enjoy, you can pick up the pieces and go try it all over again. And I think it shows a lot of courage because I think it's something we all struggle with to make that leap from one thing to another.
Yeah, I mean the ages definitely are not what they were. Because people who say 70 is the new 40 or something like that. It's funny, but it kind of feels true. I
There's
mean,
that 70-year-old woman in the Miss USA pageant this year.
I mean, modern medicine, clean living, healthy eating, and not too many vices. Moderation in all things, which is the gospel preached by my father. I'm in many ways quite robust. My memory seems still sharp. I'm constantly testing myself, and every time I forget a name, I panic for a minute, but it's never very severe. It's possible. At the same time, of course, we have the paradox of living in what is becoming one of the worst times in human history. Do I want to be living through this period? That's the next question.
Oh, yeah. I've heard this old proverb, may you live in interesting times, and I guess it's supposed to be a curse, and yeah, that's something I've sort of started to feel pretty viscerally. I would like boring times. I would like a spate of some pretty boring years in the future.
I miss the 1970s dreadfully, and I remember in the middle of the 1970s, looking through the newspaper and complaining to my friend, whoever it was sitting there, saying, "Nothing ever happens these days." I miss that.
Yeah. So you throughout the book, you mentioned taking this leap to become your true self. Why do you think we're often so afraid of doing things too late or being behind? Or, like, why are we all so scared to jump?
It's human. It's these are big things, and poof. I mean, especially if you've lived a life of, that's been continuous. You went to high school, then you went to college, then you got married, then you got a big job, et cetera. In those circumstances, you've been traveling down a straight highway. I've been fortunate enough that my highway has taken all kinds of turns and detours over the years. So in a way, it was maybe less scary for me than it would be for a lot of other people. Uncertainty was really part of my self-definition. And also, I've kind of always lived by my wits. I just retired from last year from teaching college after, well, 27 years overall. But that was very part-time. And I've lived as a freelance writer really since the age of 20, calculating here, 24.
Which comes with its own uncertainties.
It's a life of taking a lot of chances. At the same time, though, because I was instructed by my parents and my father especially, his extreme caution in both making these wild leaps like across the Atlantic, but at the same time having figured out, every possible contingency along the way, that I'm not as good at that kind of stuff as he is, but it did leave me with an ability to solidify my base while taking leaps. So being coming out as transgender at age 66, I was pretty well supported. My name is already known. I had a career. I have a house. I have a car. I have a son who's about to turn 25, and he's completely understanding. My life in a lot of ways was already nailed down before I took this wild leap. So I did not face the problems that many other people who come out, including people who come out in later life. Yes, I did lose my romantic relationship of 14 years, but at the same time, I didn't lose her. And I didn't lose a single friend from this, not one.
And then
You
you
know,
got to,
so I'm sorry.
oh, I was just going to say, and then you got to experience adolescence again in a way, including
In a
these like
way.
very real moments where you realize the limitations of being a woman with a long torso.
Yes,
And
right. I learned a lot about clothing, yes.
yeah, well, as a woman with very long legs, like I have the opposite problem. yeah, and because they're women's clothes, like I have always lamented, are cut so wildly different from men's clothing, and like a six isn't a six isn't a six in like all these different sizes, and there's all these different versions of the woman you can be. How did you land on the woman you wanted to be? Because I feel like it took me decades of trying on different outfits and imagining myself as the kind of woman that would wear them.
Well, I'm still working things out, of course. And I'm very lucky that, by pure coincidence, I had, in a completely unrelated move, sold my archives to the New York Public Library, and I got paid not long after my egg cracked. So I had money to make mistakes, and I make tons of mistakes. I donated so many clothes to charity. I realized, well, it kind of reflects my life. I realized like my haircut is pure 1965, and that's actually the year that I was, as far as I can reconstruct things, it was around then that I was becoming aware that I was trans. So no wonder. And I'm European, and I've always had the strong, yeah, I live here. I am an American in many ways, but I'm also a European. So there's a European sense to it. I find myself being a European woman of a certain age with perhaps a kind of rich hippie past. I've constructed a whole alternate personality based on for the clothing aspect anyway. A lot of it feels familiar because I realize, I'm drawing on, fantasies I might have had 40 years ago. My palette is limited because I'm colorblind. My sense of line is very strong. And I have a real feeling for textile, which I think is hereditary or something, since I do come from a textile town. It's fun. I make mistakes. I still make mistakes, but I have lineaments figured out much more. And how comfortable I am wearing these clothes also, that plays into it. I find myself still to this day, I find myself putting on something and saying, oh, that's too femme. So there's always going to be a little bit something non-binary about my presentation, actually.
I like that you can make peace with that, though. That's the kind of woman you want to present yourself as.
Yes, right. Yeah. It's I mean, to me, probably the strongest influence on my taste, really, or my old friends, my old female friends who I've had in some cases for 50 years. I've seen how they evolved, and I've learned to look at things through their eyes in many ways. So I'm very well aware of how a woman my age, who's not ready to curl up and die, is going to present herself. Not ready to curl up and die, but also no longer a teenager. It's a mix of a mix of daring and conservatism in dress. You know, this it's a balance of things. And it's a whole new art form for me to play with.
You end your book by saying, "I don't mind representing myself as an example of someone who has found happiness by confronting the truth." And I think that's a great way to end our conversation together, because that's really, to me, what your book was about making peace with the person in the mirror. And so, Lucy Sandy, I just want to say thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you, Anna. It's been a real pleasure, seriously.
Lucy's new book, I Heard Her Call My Name, is out now. Thank you all so much for listening to All Sides with Anna Staver on 89.7 NPR News.